Moses, once led on by his love of learning, sought also the causes by which the most necessary events in the world are accomplished. For as he beheld the things in creation, some perishing and being generated, some being destroyed, yet others remaining, he was struck with amazement, overwhelmed, and cried out, saying, "Why is it that the bush burns and is not consumed?" Exod 3:2-3. For he does not pry into the untrodden place, the dwelling of divine natures. But when he was already about to engage in an endless and unaccomplishable labor, he was relieved by the mercy and providence of God, the Savior of all, who spoke an oracle from the inner shrine. "Do not draw near here," Exod 3:5, equivalent to "do not approach such an inquiry," for the task belongs to a curiosity and meddlesomeness greater than human power allows. Rather, marvel at the things that have come to be, but do not pry into the causes by which they came to be or perish. For the place on which you stand, it says, is holy ground, Exod 3:5. What place is this? Clearly it is the place concerned with causation, which he attached to the divine natures alone, judging no human being competent to lay hold of causation. He then, out of longing for knowledge, peering above the whole world, seeks concerning the maker of the world, who this hard to see and hard to conjecture being is, whether body or bodiless or something above these, or a simple nature such as a unit or a composite or something else among existing things. And seeing that this is hard to hunt down and hard to conceive, he prays to learn from God himself who God is, for he did not hope to be able to learn it from any other of the beings that come after him. But even so, he had no power to inquire into anything concerning the essence of the one who is. "For you shall see what is behind me," it says, "but my face you shall not see," Exod 33:23. For it suffices the wise man to know the things that follow and attend upon God and all that comes after him. But whoever wishes to gaze upon the essence that governs all will be blinded by the surrounding brilliance of the rays before he sees it. Having discussed so much concerning the third heading, let us pass on to the fourth and last of the topics proposed, according to which discovery loves to come forward even when no inquiry has taken place. Under this heading is ranked every self-taught and self-instructed sage. For he was not improved by considerations, exercises, and labors, but as soon as he came into being, he found wisdom already prepared, rained down from above out of heaven, and having drawn deep of its unmixed draught, he feasted, and continued drunk with that sober intoxication that comes with right reason. This is the one whom the oracles named Isaac, whom the soul did not conceive at one time and bear at another. For it says, "Having conceived, she bore," Gen 21:2, as though timelessly. For what was being born was not a man, but a thought most pure, beautiful by nature rather than by cultivation, for which reason the one who bore it is also said to have ceased to have the way of women, Gen 18:11, the customary, reasonable, and human way. For the self-taught kind is new and beyond reason and truly divine, constituted not by human devisings, but by divine frenzy. Or are you unaware that Hebrew women have no need of midwives for childbirth, but give birth, as Moses says, before the midwives come in, Exod 1:19. I mean the methods, arts, and sciences using nature alone as their helper. And it gives most beautiful and most fitting definitions of the self-taught. One such is this, that which is found quickly, the other, that which God has handed down. Now that which is taught requires a long time, while that which comes by nature is swift and in a manner timeless, and the one has a man as its guide, the other, God. The former definition he set down in a question, "What is this that you found so quickly, my child?" The other in an answer, saying, "What the Lord God handed to me," Gen 27:20. There is also a third definition of the self-taught, that which comes up of itself, for it is said among the exhortations, "You shall not sow, nor shall you reap the things that come up of themselves," Lev 25:11. For the things that come by nature have no need of art, since God himself sows them and brings them to completion by the art of husbandry, so that things not truly spontaneous appear as though spontaneous, except insofar as they had no need at all of human contrivance. And this is not so much an exhortation as it is a declaration of judgment, for if he were advising, he would have said, "Do not sow, do not reap," but declaring, he says, "You shall not sow, nor shall you reap the things that come up of themselves." For of the things we obtain that grow spontaneously from nature, we find that we ourselves are the cause of neither their beginnings nor their ends, the beginning being the sowing, and the end the reaping. But it is better to understand it thus. Every beginning and every end is spontaneous, that is, it is nature's work, not ours. For instance, what is the beginning of learning? Clearly, it is that nature in the one being taught which is receptive to particular teachings. And what, again, is the beginning of being brought to perfection? If one must speak without holding anything back, it is nature. For the teacher is capable of producing advances, but the perfection that reaches the summit belongs to God alone, the best nature. He who is nourished on these doctrines lives in everlasting peace, released from unwearying toils. And the peace of the seventh day, according to the lawgiver, admits of no distinction, for in it, creation lays aside the appearance of activity and rests. Fittingly, then, it is said, "And the Sabbaths of the land shall be food for you." Lev 25:6, by way of hidden meaning. For only the rest that is in God is nourishing and enjoyable, procuring the greatest good, peace unmixed with war. For the peace found among cities is tainted with civil strife, while the peace of the soul is unmixed with any discord. It seems to me that the following passage most vividly represents discovery without inquiry. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers to give you, great and goodly cities that you did not build, houses full of every good thing that you did not fill, cisterns hewn out that you did not hew, vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. Deut 6:10-11. Do you see the abundance of great goods poured out and ready for possession and enjoyment? The generic virtues are likened to cities, because they extend most broadly. The particular virtues to houses, for these are drawn into a narrower circle. Well-formed souls are likened to cisterns, easily filled with wisdom as those are with water. And to vineyards and olive groves are likened progress, growth, and the production of fruits. The fruit of knowledge is the contemplative life, which produces unmixed joy as from wine, and intelligible light as from a flame, whose nourishment is oil. Having said this much about finding, let us move on next to what follows in our approach. The angel of the Lord found her, he says, at the spring of water, Gen 16:7. Now spring is used in many senses, in one our own mind, in another the rational disposition and education, in a third the base condition, in a fourth the excellent condition opposed to it, and in a fifth the maker and father of all things himself. The oracles that have been recorded show the proofs of these. We must examine what they are. Right at the beginning of the law, immediately after the creation of the world, a certain verse is sung out. A spring rose up from the earth and watered the whole face of the earth. Gen 2:6. Those uninitiated into allegory and into a nature that loves to hide itself, like in the spring just mentioned to the Egyptian river, which floods the plain every year, seeming almost to display a power that imitates the sky. What the sky is to other regions in winter, the Nile is to Egypt when summer is at its height. The sky sends rain down from above onto the earth, but the Nile, most paradoxically, flows from below upward and waters the fields by its flow. Starting from this, Moses too, not without insight, described the Egyptian way of thinking as one that prefers earth to heaven, things of the land to the Olympian gods, and the body to the soul. But it will be possible to speak of these matters again another time, when circumstances allow. For now, since we must aim not to speak at excessive length, we should return to the interpretation by way of implied meanings, and say that a spring rose up and watered the whole face of the earth means something like this. Our governing faculty, as though from a spring, pours out many powers as if through channels in the earth, and sends these powers on to the organs of sense, eyes, ears, nostrils, and the rest, which belong to every living creature around the head and face. So the governing part of the body, that is, the face, is watered as if from a spring by the governing part that belongs to the soul. The visual spirit stretching out to the eyes, the auditory to the ear, the olfactory to the nostrils, the gustatory in turn to the mouth, and the tactile over the whole surface of the body. There are also the manifold springs of education, beside which grow upright and most nourishing words, like the trunks of palm trees. For it says, "They came to a limb, and in a limb there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trunks, and they camped there beside the water," Exod 15:27. A limb is translated gates, a symbol of the entrance to virtue, for just as gates are the beginnings of a house, so the general course of preliminary studies is the beginning of virtue. 12 is a perfect number. Witness the zodiac circle in the sky, set with just that many luminous stars. Witness too the sun's revolution, which completes its circuit in 12 months, and men reckon the hours of day and night in numbers equal to the months of the year. Moses praises this number in no small number of places. He records 12 tribes of the nation, legislates 12 loaves of the presentation bread, and orders that 12 engraved stones be woven into the sacred vestment, into the ankle-length robe, upon the breastpiece, Exod. 28:17ff. He also praises the number 7 multiplied by 10. Here, saying there were 70 palm trees by the springs, elsewhere that there were 70 elders alone, upon whom the divine and prophetic spirit was distributed, Num 11:16. And again, that 70 calves are brought as sacrificial victims, divided into harmonious groups at the Feast of Tabernacles. For the bulls are not all sacrificed together, but over 7 days, beginning with 13 bulls, Num 29:13ff. For by subtracting one bull each successive day, all the way to the seventh, the sum total of 70 would be reached. Arriving, then, at the gateways of virtue, that is, the preliminary studies, and seeing springs there with young palm shoots beside them, they are said to camp not beside the plants but beside the waters. Why? Because those who carry off the prizes of complete virtue are crowned with palm and ribbons, whereas those who are still engaged with the whole cycle of preliminary studies, thirsting as they are for learning, settle beside the branches of knowledge that are able to irrigate and water their souls. Such, then, are the springs of intermediate education. Let us now examine the spring of folly, about which the lawgiver has spoken as follows. Whoever lies with a woman who is menstruating has uncovered her spring, and she has uncovered the flow of her blood. Let both of them be utterly destroyed. Lev 20:18. He calls sense perception the woman, taking mind to be its husband. Sense perception sits apart, that is, sits at the furthest remove, whenever it abandons the mind, its own proper husband, and settles instead among the seductive and corrupting objects of sense, entangling itself amorously with each of them. If then the mind should turn to sleep, when it ought to stay awake, it uncovers its own spring. The spring, that is, of sense perception, for the mind itself was, as I said, the spring of sense perception, and by doing so, it makes itself unroofed, unwalled, and an easy target for attack. But sense perception, too, uncovers the flow of her own blood. For sense perception, always flowing out toward the external object of sense, is covered over and held in check when it is restrained by reasoning, but it is left desolate, bereft of its rightful guide, when reasoning fails. And just as lack of walls is the gravest evil for a city, so lack of a guard is for the soul. When, then, does it become unguarded? It is when sight is left unroofed, poured out toward visible things, when hearing is left unroofed, drenched by every sound, when smell and its kindred faculties are left unroofed, ready to suffer whatever those who assail them wish to inflict, and when spoken speech, too, is left unroofed, blurting out at the wrong moment countless secrets, since nothing checks its onward rush. Flowing unchecked in this way, it has overturned great life projects that were sailing along steadily, as if in calm water. This is the great flood in which the floodgates of heaven were opened, I mean of the mind, and the springs of the abyss were uncovered. Gen 7:11, that is, the springs of sense perception. For it is only in this way that the soul is flooded, from above, as it were from the sky of the mind, when wrongdoings burst forth, and from below, as it were from the earth of sense perception, when passions pour down. For this reason, Moses forbids uncovering the shame of father and mother. Lev 18:7, knowing clearly what a great evil it is not to restrain and conceal the sins of mind and sense perception, but instead to parade them out into the open as though they were achievements. These, then, are the springs of sins. We must now search out the spring of practical wisdom. Rebecca, that is, endurance, goes down to this spring, and having filled the whole vessel of her soul, comes back up, the lawgiver quite naturally calling the descent an ascent. For virtue is lifted up to the heights whenever it resolves to come down from arrogant pride, for it says, she went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up, Gen 24:16. This spring is divine wisdom, from which the particular sciences are watered, along with every soul that loves contemplation and is possessed by love of the best. To this spring, the sacred word gives most fitting names, calling it judgment and holy. For it says, having turned back, they came to the spring of judgment. This is Kadesh. Gen 14:7, and Kadesh means holy. It all but shouts and cries out that the wisdom of God is holy, bringing with it nothing earthly, and is the judgment of all things, by which all contrarieties are separated out and judged. We must now speak of the highest and best spring, which the Father of all proclaimed through prophetic mouths. For he said somewhere, they have abandoned me, the spring of life, and dug for themselves broken cisterns that will not be able to hold water. Jer 2:13. So God is the most ancient spring, and rightly so, no doubt, for he has rained down this entire universe. I am struck with wonder when I hear that this spring belongs to life, for God alone is the cause of soul and of life, and especially of rational soul, and of life lived with practical wisdom. For matter is dead, but God is something more than life, an ever-flowing spring of living, as he himself said. But the impious, having run away, remain to this day untasting of the drink of immortality. In their derangement, they dug for themselves, and not for God in the first place, preferring their own doings to the things of heaven and Olympus, and preferring what comes from careful contrivance to what comes ready-made and spontaneous. Then, unlike Abraham and Isaac, the wise, who dig wells, Gen 21:30, 26:18, deep understandings that yield drinkable words, they dig cisterns, which have no good nourishment of their own, but need an inflow from outside, one that could come only from teaching, when instructors constantly pour into the ears of their students, all at once, the doctrines and theorems of knowledge, for the mind to grasp and memory to store up what has been handed down. But now, the pits are broken. That is, all the reservoirs of the untutored soul are shattered and leaking, unable to hold and keep safe the inflow of things that could do it good. So much, then, has been said about springs as the occasion called for. But very precisely do the oracles introduce Hagar as found at the spring, Gen 16:7, yet not drawing from it. For the soul that is still making progress is not yet able to make use of the unmixed drink of wisdom, though it is not forbidden to spend its time nearby. And the whole road that runs through education is a highway, most secure and best fortified. Hence he says she was found on the way to Shur, Ibid, and Shur is translated wall or straightness. So the conviction speaking within the soul says to her, where have you come from and where are you going? Ibid, 8. He says this not because he doubts or is asking, but rather to shame and reproach her. For it is not right for an angel to be ignorant of anything that concerns us. And here is a sign, he clearly knows even what is in the womb, which is unclear even to the one carrying it, when he says, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, Ibid, 11. For to know that the child being carried is male is beyond human power, and so is knowing, before it is even born, what course of life it will choose, namely that it will be a wild man, not civilized and gentle. Where have you come from, then, is said as a rebuke to the soul that is fleeing the better and ruling judgment, whose handmaid she was, not merely called so, but so in fact, and who was destined to carry off great renown. And where are you going? You are chasing after what is unclear, having thrown away what was agreed and acknowledged. It is right then to praise her for rejoicing at the admonition. And she has produced proofs of that joy, not accusing her mistress, laying the blame for her flight on herself, and giving no answer to the second question, where are you going? For that is unclear, and about unclear things it is both safe and necessary to suspend judgment. Accepting her obedience, the conviction says, return to your mistress, Ibid. For it is profitable to the learner to be under the oversight of the teacher, and to the imperfect to be a slave to prudence. And when you return, be humbled under her hands, Ibid. 9. A fine humbling, one that consists in pulling down an irrational pride. For with such gentle birth pangs you will bring forth a male offspring named Ishmael, Ibid. 11. Disciplined by divine hearing, for Ishmael is translated hearing of God. Hearing takes second place to sight, and sight is the portion allotted to the true and firstborn son, Israel. For by interpretation, he is one who sees God. For it is possible to hear falsehoods as though they were truths, since hearing is deceptive, but sight is free of falsehood, and by it things that truly exist are apprehended. He characterizes the manner of the one begotten both by saying he will be a wild man, a kind of rustic wise man, not yet judged worthy of the tame and truly civilized portion, and this portion is virtue, through which character is by nature made gentle, and by saying, his hands against all, and the hands of all against him, ibid. For this is the mark of a sophist, one who postures as excessively skeptical and delights in contentious arguments. This man strikes at all who belong to true learning, opposing each one individually and all of them together, and he is struck by all of them in turn, who naturally defend themselves as though defending their own children, the doctrines their soul has borne. But he assigns him a third mark as well, saying, he shall dwell over against all his brothers, ibid. Almost openly displaying the face-to-face conflict and everlasting opposition. So the soul pregnant with the sophist's reasoning says to the conviction speaking within her, you are the God who watches over me, ibid. 13. Equivalent to you are the maker of my intentions and my offspring, and not without reason. For to free souls, truly free, truly citizen souls, he is a free and freedom-making craftsman, but to slaves he is a slave. Angels are the household servants of God, though considered gods by those still bound in toils and slavery. Therefore, it says, she called the well of him whom I saw before me, ibid. 14. But were you not going to, O soul still making progress and going deep into the learning of the general preliminary studies, see, as though through a mirror made of education, the cause of that learning? And most fitting is the location of such a well, between Kadesh and Bird, ibid. 14. Bird is translated in evils, and Kadesh, holy. For it lies on the border between holy things and profane, in the midst of progress, fleeing what is base, but not yet capable of living together with things that are perfectly good.